Abelia? Melissa? Dvorah? Meh? It's not doing anything for you? What if I said Deseret?
Okay, I was worried there for a minute. I had no idea what was happening, but I see what you're up to here. Fine. Bees it is.
Beads?
Bees. Why can't we talk tonight on this podcast? Thanks to Joseph Smith looking into seer stones and definitely not the Urim and Thummim, Ether Chapter 2 in the Book of Mormon introduced the word Deseret into the world. And oh boy, would later generations love it. So, it's time for a game, listeners. It's simple. It's a game that Brian came up with called Shiz or Coriantumr, and it works like this. The real companies are Coriantumr, while the bogus ones are Shiz. Ready? Lovely. Let's roll. First one up, Deseret Armory.
Armory? Seriously? Guns right out of the gate? Ugh, I'm voting Shiz here.
Oh, you'd make a bad Jaredite. That's pure Coriantumr. It's a real company. Next one, Deseret Salted Cured Meats.
Nice try, Costanza. That one's gotta be Shiz.
Shiz it is. Okay, is this a real company? Deseret Doodles Dogs and Cat Hills.
Jeez. All right, I feel like I'm getting Kirillam fished here. Okay, that one feels shizzy, but I'm gonna go with my gut here. Coriantumr?
Ding, ding, ding. Your answers have been stamped with the more sure word of promise. Congrats. It's a real company name.
Okay, let's bracket the doodles, dogs, and cats for just a second, because we need to talk about Deseret. Given how often that it shows up in Utah later, you figure it has to start with Joseph Smith, right? Well, no. I mean, yes, it's in the Book of Mormon, but if you go visit our good friends at the Joseph Smith Papers, you're going to find exactly zero mentions during his life. What gives? Why did Brigham Young have so many bees in his vintage bonnet?
Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young, that only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
Lindsay, did you know that Lynn Whitesides and Paul Toscano wear the same size shoe?
Seriously? Wait. No, that's gotta be Shiz.
Fine. It's most definitely Shiz. But they do share something else in common. In the single month of September 1993, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints excommunicated or disciplined six of its members. These six individuals, some of them intellectuals, some activists, some of them both, were soon dubbed the September Six. In the September Six and the struggle for the soul of Mormonism, Sarum Patterson challenges readers to think more deeply about the events of that month and the era in which they unfolded. Patterson argues that the clever alliterative phrase, September Six, masks our ability to see what happened that month was part of a much broader, decades-long cultural and theological debate over the nature of the church and its restoration narrative. During those decades, the institutional church invested in and policed a purity system, expecting believers to practice doctrinal, familial, and bodily purity. Dissenters within the institution pushed back, imagining instead a vision of the restoration that embraced personal conscience, truth-seeking and telling, and social egalitarianism at its core. Both sides were profoundly shaped by the cultural milieu that surrounded them. What happened in September 1993 continues to echo in the church today, having lasting effects on the institution, its believers, and the broader culture. The September 6 and the Struggle for the Soul of Mormonism by historian Sarah Patterson. New from Signature Books. Get it from Benchmark Books, or Boyd Packer will call your stake president. We're not joking.
Deseret, huh? Let's buzz. From the second they arrived in the valley, as Dale Morgan points out, Mormons were a little different than other areas being colonized by white settlers in the West. Thanks to the tradition of a high council, they had made a ready form of government. In the first couple of years, they passed more than 100 ordinances. They represented the realities of the Wild West, ordinances regarding stray cattle, stealing, drunkenness, vagrancy, and, most importantly, not wiping poop on people you don't agree with. Maybe there should have been one for the last problem because that happened in Nauvoo, and it clearly had to happen in Utah. Some of the ordinances smelled a lot like normal government, creating a currency, setting up a cemetery, those kinds of boring things.
Dale Morgan had a good insight. Quote, "The government in Great Salt Lake Valley grew out of the needs of the settlers and represented a maximum of political reality and a minimum of political theory. A spontaneous government immediately responsive to popular needs and accreting such laws and functions as the public good required. Had the Mormons been living in a political vacuum, they might have subsisted indefinitely without a formal political structure of the type of the provisional state of Deseret." But see, the thing, of course, obviously, is they were increasingly not in a vacuum, and eventually they would have to reckon with living in the world again.
Here's the thing. If you were an average resident of the Great Salt Lake City in the early years, you didn't have a lot of options. You could either go hoe your potatoes or help your neighbor hoe their potatoes, or perhaps plan for how to hoe your potatoes the next day. Options. Given these exotic choices, even going to a meeting probably sounded really interesting. Even if you knew you'd have to listen to Brigham Young, followed by Heber C. Kimball. Now, if you knew what YTFIF was backwards, it's the crappy code for the Council of 50, you might get to go to meetings that were legitimately interesting. For example, if your Phelps Almanac said that today was March 4th, 1849, you would have been hanging out in Heber Kimball's house promptly at 9:30 MST, that's Mormon Standard Time, to learn actually about another meeting. In just over a week, the people of Great Salt Lake City would gather to elect provisional officers until the U.S. got its butt in gear and granted it territorial status.
This new entity, it would be known as Deseret. The question was, what sort of animal would it be? Is it a state? Is it a territory? On the one hand, David Bigler argues that Brigham and company initially were leaning towards territory because it would be easier to disentangle once the Kingdom of God was ready to go on its own. Leo Lyman, however, suggests that statehood was always the goal, since territorial officials were appointed by Washington. Our favorite fun-sized Mormon ally was, of course, at the ready. Thomas Kane felt like they couldn't quite make the jump to statehood at first, so he takes a plan for territorial status back to President James K. Polk in February 1848. Initially, things looked good. Democrats were in favor of popular sovereignty at that point, but Polk couldn't make it happen. And that was it. Mormon's first chance at government, down the tubes. There were some mentions of another try during the summer, but they really didn't go anywhere.
No worries. When in doubt, try and trick the government. Mormons set out to create their own government that could just be rubber stamped by the boys back east. In December of 1848, the Council of 50 met again at Heber Kimball's little tiny house to start their own petition for territorial government. However, they wanted to make it clear to the federal muckety-mucks that they wanted to appoint their own dudes. Soon, friends back east would gently remind them, guys, that's not how territories work. President Daddy gets to pick, you guys. So they all got out their fancy quills from all of those birds that they had killed and had everyone sign the petition. More than 2,000 names were collected. They picked a slate of officials and then everyone, quote, voted in March. And that's voted in air quotes because we know how Mormons vote together. Hopefully you heard the quotes around it because they are justified. Listen to this. A study of 18 elections from 1852 to 1870 found that 96% of the 96,107 votes cast during this period went to the church ticket. From 1847 to 1874, not one candidate chosen in advance by Mormon leaders failed to win the election. Yeah, they, air quote, voted.
Bruce Worthen, who wrote a study about another very important figure for today, John Bernheisel, outlined the next steps. They had to hold a convention, elect a legislature, write a constitution, and so on. He points out that they did all of this in just 2 weeks. Bruce helpfully explains that the reason they could do it so quickly is because they basically did none of it. No convention, no election, no convening the legislature. All they did was create paperwork later saying that they did. I probably don't need to remind you, but in 1849, it was impossible for President Daddy back in Washington to come out and double-check their work. This set a precedent for the coming years, telling Washington one thing and then doing another. Sometimes you'll hear the process called ghost government, which is much less scary, but way more deceptive than it sounds. This is great. Hosea Stout was appointed to this bogus state legislature and wrote in his diary, quote, "By what process I became a representative, I know not." In the official records, Ulhosey is an integral part in the legislature, but in reality, the dude is back home building a barn. And this part of the story is fun. Earlier historians couldn't figure out why it seemed like there were two parallel projects, one for territoryhood and one for statehood. Well, these imaginary records were at the heart of this confusion.
Their ambitions were, let's say, ambitious. The suggested state of Deseret covered all part of modern-day Utah, Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, California, Oregon, Idaho, and Wyoming, basically a big chunk of the United States. It's a little bit of a land grab. They would rule most of the West from Colorado to the sea at San Diego. And the Constitution had been drafted secretly, and like earlier attempts, remember notably the Nauvoo City Charter, it drew heavily on other states, particularly Iowa. They were cheating off their neighbors. As Leo Lyman summarized, it had some, quote, deviations to remove any separation between church and state. I'm glad they took out the important things and made in the important changes. Remember that since arriving in the Valley had been made by the very active High Council, obviously they weren't going to change things up much.
But see, that part makes sense. We still do this today. How many times a day are you wondering how to make a decision, and then you ask yourself, how is Iowa handling this? Constantly, right? Like 12 times a day.
Let the Hawkeyes lead the way, I always say. It's funny though, honestly, because the nation was a fan of this new Iowa plagiarized constitution. Newspapers across the country were happy that it was such a great constitution and definitely showed that the Mormons were steering away from a theodemocracy, or at least they thought. Meanwhile, Brigham is back in Salt Lake giggling at how easy this was. Heber, holy crap, they're buying it. And on a more serious note, Leo Lyman sees all of this as a part of the Brighamifying of Utah, and it's a real word. Ask the Joseph Smith polygamy deniers. They'll tell you all about it. He points out that the national leaders, guys like Stephen Douglas, basically just decide to let the government set up in Utah stand since Brigham was already in charge. He had accomplished this by running over both the 12 and the Council of 50. Hold that thought for about 30 years, if you would.
This really was the summer of Brigham. For the next 9 years, he would sit in the governor's Lazy Boy with the fridge built into the side, decompressing. Some of the decisions made from the Lazy Boy were not the best. Sending Almon Babbitt back to Washington? Definitely not one of them. As Leo Lyman notes, he was basically the opposite of John Bernheisel. He was apparently not great at wooing senators. Bernheisel was pretty good at this. His main obstacle was Brigham and others shooting off their mouth back in Salt Lake. Left to his own designs, Bernheisel was usually as successful as one can be while keeping a theopolitical kingdom alive and thriving right in the middle of the American democracy.
The biggest problem for anyone anywhere at this time is obviously a growing tension regarding enslavement and America. And after a long tour of just about everything and everywhere, John Bernheisel has arrived in Washington and was sweet-talking every congressman and senator that he could. One day he went to a lecture by Horace Mann, who afterwards asked about the Mormon view of slavery, and Bernheisel pulled a W.W. Phelps and apparently said that there was, quote, nothing in the Mormon religion prohibiting it. It's kind of a big oops in 1849 and always. When this hits the newspaper, it leads Northern leaders to wonder if Utah isn't secretly cozying up to the South.
The most serious division in American history was really starting to heat up. At this point, neither of the two main parties, the Whigs and the Democrats, held a majority. They're each trying to get the Free Soil Party on their side, but they're not having much success. There's this one guy who's constantly trying to outlaw slavery in the lands gained after the Mexican War, which includes, obviously, Utah. The South is always countering by threatening to make the gears of government grind to a halt unless proposals like this were tabled, for example. John Bernheisel described the scene when the congressman from Virginia insisted that the Speaker of the House had to be a guy that wouldn't listen to any of these anti-slavery proposals. The guy from New York accused him of trying to break up the Union. Virginia denies it. New York calls him a liar. One reporter says that, quote, indescribable confusion ensued with threats, violence, and, I absolutely love this, gesticulations. Could you be more 19th century?
Bernheisel is doing his best in the middle of all of this. His biographer notes that he was given privileges and was highly regarded, but let's be honest. How successful can a single bald guy from Utah be in the face of a train barreling down on him labeled the Civil War? Everyone wants to know about Utah's perspective on this elephant in the room. In the South, of course, are big fans that their constitution has exactly zero words about slavery, while the North is super suspicious that, you know, the constitution has exactly zero words on slavery. So Bernheisel consults a friend and mentor who has him write up carefully worded responses to questions on slavery, but, and this should be no surprise given the climate, it was a waste of time. He starts hearing from everyone that Utah becoming a state isn't looking good. No one's a fan. On the other side of the coin, he is concerned that becoming a territory with federally appointed officials is also a recipe for disaster. Say what you will about good old Johnny B, but he was pretty astute politically.
Bernheisel is also meeting with the president. And, oh yeah, who's the president at this point? Mr. Zachary Taylor, the military hero, nicknamed Old Rough and Ready. As Bernheisel watches him in person, he snarks on Zach, quote, "He is rough enough, though he does not appear to be very ready." That's a sick burn, bruh. The Prez thinks he's got a grand plan to avoid more conflicts in the West. However, turns out the Deseret didn't even meet the population requirement for statehood. Bernheisel's mentor has his own grand plan. What if Washington just paid the salaries of the provisional officers in Deseret, and then they just keep going like they'd been doing? This doesn't get them any representation in Washington, but Bernheisel feels like, given everything, they could probably live with that.
Hand down your head now, what have you done? Hand down. Down your head now, what have you done? It's time to say goodbye.
In a plot twist that would make M. Night Shyamalan proud, old Punchy McGee himself, crazy little brother William Smith, unexpectedly storms back into frame. At this point, he's living in Kentucky because why not? And he hears about the plans for Utah statehood. And, you know, he's not a big fan of Brigham and the Mormons at this point, so he takes this very inopportune moment to let the government know that the endowment included an oath of vengeance for the murder of Joseph and Hiram Smith, and they are treasonous enough through and through that they shouldn't be trusted. I mean, I think you can see that he's not completely making this stuff up, lacks a little self-reflection, but anyway, so President Taylor calls an immediate timeout so they can investigate William Smith's charges. The one-man PR machine of John Bernheisel kicks into high gear. He has tons of one-on-ones with congressmen that he hastily schedules. He gives them copies of Thomas Kane's pamphlets on the Mormons, saying, hey, look, they're good guys. He gets the tide turned back when Elman Babbitt rolls into the district.
John Bernheisel had to have been super pissed. He'd already tangled with Babbitt in the Midwest because Babbitt had created a political firestorm by promising votes on one hand and then also fighting with Orson Hyde on the other. Hyde was sick of Elman Babbitt. He had him disfellowshipped, but then Brigham immediately reinstated him. Brigham and anybody named Orson, man, that's a bad combo. This time, Babbitt was trying to capitalize on the William Smith fiasco for his own good. President Taylor had said during his campaign that he would let Congress handle domestic issues. Babbitt realizes that if he can get everyone to see that Taylor had called for an investigation of the William Smith allegations, decidedly a domestic issue, the Democrats could then embarrass the president.
Bernheisel can see right through Babbitt, and he is pissed. He marches over to Babbitt's apartment and he literally drags him out of bed, yells at him to knock it off, and Babbitt is shocked with some good reason. Babbitt is still the official delegate for the provisional state of Deseret back home, and Bernheisel is apparently a commissioner. For office fans, does Dwight, the assistant to the regional manager, or Andy, the regional director of sales, outrank the other? We all know how it would go down on a movie set. So Babbitt learns that letters headed to the district are going to Bernheisel, not to him, and he doesn't like that. He gets pretty whiny about it. If there's something Mormon men don't like, is their priesthood being outranked? He writes to Wilford Woodruff, who is again the head honcho in the East, and Woodruff has to be thinking, why do I get all the crazies when I'm back here? Remember, he had to deal with the Smash Brothers a couple of years earlier in Boston, and now he's got Elman Babbitt on his ticket, and crybaby delegate of Deseret.
If there's anything better than political intrigue in the East, it's political intrigue in the West at the same time. While Johnny B is pitching his woo in the district, there is a California plan brewing. Oddly enough, two enslavers are at the center of a plan to get California admitted as a free state. The thought was that maybe a California-Deseret mashup could happen.
Californorette?
That name sounds a little shizzy.
Deserfornia?
See, that's got a better ring to it. The thought was if they could get admitted, they could split off the eastern portion as Deseret in a couple of years. Brigham and Company could see that Deseret being admitted as a state on its own was growing less sexy by the day. They figured Californiarette was better than nothing.
At this point, we are figuring you realize that the general lack of Deserfornia flags on your flagpoles is your answer. Brigham is trying to get up-to-the-minute instructions to amass alignment on the ground in California, and hopefully you remember that it's not a thing in 1849. California doesn't exist quite yet. Up-to-the-month instructions are iffy. California is actually in a giant fight about their own proposal, and honestly, if Mormon dudes had been at the convention, they might have actually adopted a plan to create California from the entire old Alta California, which of course included Utah. Go away, John Taylor. Why did I even say that out loud?
Mormons aren't done. They go to the provisional governor to see if they can kind of hand in a late assignment. What if California just called another convention to create this larger state? The governor doesn't say no immediately, but he does tell Amasa and company that it's probably a pipe dream. The first convention had been a giant mess, and nobody was excited to do a sequel. The dream for East California died. Well, let's go back to the Eastern Front then.
Statehood is pretty much off the table, but before any territory ideas can proceed, there are a few things to work out. Some smaller, like the name. Nobody likes the name Deseret. Such anti-Book of Mormon bigots. It sounds too much like desert. No kidding, tell that to our autocorrect every time we try to type it in now. The larger problem, pun 100% intended, is the proposed area. Way, way, way too big. Obviously, with California being more successful with their pitch, we have to carve off that part. Ultimately, the solution is to include all of Nevada, minus the triangle on the bottom, Utah, and parts of Colorado and Wyoming.
Because it's the 19th century, an unexpected death just has to be part of the script. No, it's not Almon Babbitt, but hold that thought for a few years. No, it's not John Bernheisel. What if I told you it was the president? Yep. Zachary Taylor died in July 1850. Within a week of Independence Day, he goes from healthy to super, super dead. The official cause was cholera morbus, which is just the catch-all term for angry guts. Why did he die? Who knows? Bad water, bad food, lots of options. No, Hosea Stout did not poison him. You see how the rest of the world works at this point? The president of the whole ass United States dies suddenly, and nobody suggests he's poisoned. Sorry, end rant.
This tragic event will provide Brigham Young with an opportunity to really Brigham up. Stupid, stupid Almon Babbitt had written a letter to Brigham telling him that the president had talked smack about Mormons. 2 days later, he is dead. Now, how do you think Brigham Young would address the national tragedy? I'm going to just let you guess which is shiz and which is Coriantumr. Option one, quote, "It is indeed a shame to hear of the president's demise. We express our sorrow as a people at this happening." Or option two, "I love the government and the Constitution of the United States, but I do not love the damn rascals who administer the government. I know Zachary Taylor. He is dead and damned, and I cannot help it." I think you know with every fiber of your listener being which one is Coriantumr. Even the most rose-colored glasses defender Brigham Young has to admit that this was an incredibly stupid thing to say. In the interest of accuracy, he actually said this a little later during the dust-up with the territorial officials. Oops, that was a spoiler. Disregard that.
Zachary Taylor's death was not great for the Mormons. They actually had some slight momentum for statehood in Washington, including from Bernheisel's mentor. The new butt in the seat, one Millard Fillmore, opted to head for the Compromise of 1850. Fun fact, the term MILF was created for Fillmore's campaign buttons. Okay, it wasn't, but that sounds good. Fillmore's choice to head down the compromise path meant that statehood was totally dead. Bernheisel knew this wasn't great. He ran around trying to warn everyone he could that this is not going to end well. Once again, they floated the idea of just kind of letting the provisional government in Deseret ride. Honestly, nothing is happening in Washington. Letting the Mormons have their way was not exactly the biggest priority on the list.
So they weren't the belle of the ball in Congress, but Mormons were definitely one of the bells. What to do with the West was always a topic on the floor of Congress, and as usual, the key topic was enslavement. Once again, Bernheisel was a witness to this craziness. Two congressmen were arguing about whether slavery should be allowed in the former Mexican territories, and one of them threw a chair and went after the other. And the second guy pulled a gun on him, and the chair thrower called him a coward and dared him to shoot, and it took Henry Clay to calm the storm. Listen, they didn't call him the great compromiser for kicks and giggles. This is the atmosphere in which Utah was born.
Henry Clay had a great master plan that would ease everyone's minds and get the country back on track. Wait, I'm being told that absolutely no one on earth could do this. Maybe Dolly Parton? Maybe. All of this starts falling apart. The way Bernheisel described the outcome from his vantage point was that, quote, "Nothing survived the wreck but the bill providing for the establishment of a territorial government for Deseret." Yep, there's the T word, territory. That, of course, means federal appointees, the exact thing Bernheisel had been warning everyone was a terrible idea. Also, Utah, the actual physical entity of Utah, felt the direct effect of the boiling tensions between North and South. To placate the South, who wanted to extend the Missouri Compromise line to the ocean, Congress chopped the size down, like we mentioned earlier.
So hooray for Utah, though, right? Sure, it was Utah light, and it was a territory, and, well, okay, hold that hooray, maybe. As Bernheisel's biographer points out, he had to turn on the charm again. Since the appointees would come from Washington, he talked to the new guy, Millard Fillmore, and did the proactive move of providing a list of people who would be acceptable to Utah. Old MILF cooperated to a degree. Brigham Young for governor, sure. A few guys from the list, too. But three spots were reserved for the time-honored patronage system. You would think that getting a majority of the officials from your list would be acceptable to the Mormons, right? Given that that was not how territories worked in the first place, so they should be pretty happy for what they got. Oh no, not even close.
These guys that are appointed to Utah were walking into a buzzsaw without even knowing it was coming. First, they got to go to BF Utah. This is like being named ambassador to Mongolia. The guys started arriving in 1851. Lemuel Brandeberry was the Chief Justice of the Territorial Supreme Court. Broughton Harris, who arrives with Bernheisel and Babbitt, is the Territorial Secretary. And Perry Brocas is the Associate Justice. And that's all we're going to say about them right now because, wow, do we have a story for you about them coming up. And it wouldn't take long to develop either. Like, it starts the second they're in earshot of Brigham Young. All the while, Bernheisel is trying to placate Brigham Young. Listen, my dude, I'm sorry we didn't get everything we wanted, but we don't have to say a bunch of stupid crap in public, right? Right?
We need to talk for a minute about the Constitution and makeup of this shiny new territory. Because there actually was a tiny amount of butt-kissing for Washington, which the Mormons hated to do. They did this by naming the first capital of Utah Fillmore, which it didn't exist in a county named Millard, but super transparent, sure. Unfortunately, that was about the only time ever where Brigham Young even attempted to play nice with the feds. He's like, we'll name a very ugly part of central Utah, no offense, Fillmore. Fillmore, after the president. A few odds and ends about the Constitution, too. There was an entry regarding doctors and medicine, and this continued a long-standing suspicion of the guys in white coats by Mormons. I mean, considering calomel was still one of the most commonly prescribed cures, can we really blame them?
And another long-standing suspicion was of lawyers. The legislature would similarly kick this down the road, prohibiting any law not specifically adopted by them to be used in any trial, nor any other decision made by another court to be used. As David Bigler points out, quote, "This eliminated the two standard foundations of American justice, legal precedents and English common law." And elections would also try to keep the world out. The secret ballot was not allowed, which led to those steamroller results we mentioned earlier. In an effort to control the courts, probate courts, with judges appointed by Governor Prophet Brigham Young, were the only acceptable venue. Since district court judges came from Washington, Mormons were not so subtly instructed to keep their matters in probate. On a similar note, bishops were justices of the peace. All of this is well and good if you're just a middle-of-the-road Mormon, but what if you're, say, someone coming through to the Goldfields, or some weirdo who just decides to settle in Utah? You're not exactly going to have a lot of recourse. One early, very troubling, and prophetic example came from a group headed to California that was forced to winter in Utah in late 1849. They alleged that some immigrants disappeared due to shooting, strangling, beheading, drowning. Yikes. These guys petitioned Congress to disband the entire territorial legislature.
Well, on that dismal note, it's time to bid farewell to the state of Deseret and say hello to Utah Territory. And we'll be talking more about it and how it develops over the next batch of episodes. I mean, we can't leave you hanging on the federal officials, can we? Trust us, you're going to want to come back for that one. And here's the thing, don't feel too bad for Deseret. It will soon come back to life. As an alphabet. That's a weird pivot. Oh, and a university too.
Go Utes! Sometimes it's hard to be a woman, giving all your love to just one Books of Mormon's report, powered by Benchmark Books. Let's start with the first study of this whole process. Way back in 1939, Dale Morgan, a decrepit elderly man of 25 years old at this point, was tasked with writing an intro to the ordinances of the state of Deseret. As Dale was wont to do, he threw himself into it. By the time he's done, it was a full-fledged study of this complicated story. It was first published in the Utah Historical Quarterly. In fact, it brought the periodical back to life. Considering Dale's nascent status as historian and the fact he was completely blazing new trails, it's still an impressive piece. Next, David Bigler's Forgotten Kingdom from the Kingdom in the West series. It's a study of Utah history until statehood, so it's not quite as detailed as some other works, but it's very good. Then, Leo Lyman's Finally Statehood, published by Signature Books, which is on sale right now, which is a fascinating history of every attempt for statehood, including this crazy first one. This is a very underappreciated book. Highly recommended, especially for the final successful attempt that does as good a job as anything at describing why Wilford Woodruff's manifesto was issued. Finally, Bruce Worthen's recent biography of John Bernheisel, Mormon Envoy. I remember a friend of the podcast, Paul Reeve, who was Bruce's dissertation chair, telling us that Bruce's book would be so good, and he was not wrong. Really well written and exhaustive in research, Bernheisel is such an important figure, and this study of him does a really good job of outlining all the crazy crap he goes through in Washington. Actually, okay, now finally. Friend of the podcast Joe Geisner reminded us of Peter Crawley's excellent article in BYU Studies on the Constitution of the State of Deseret. It's a very good summary of much of the background needed for the creation of Utah Territory. As always, you can get these and everything else in the Mormon universe at Benchmark Books. Visit Benchmark in Salt Lake or at benchmarkbooks.com. And let my breast be cut asunder, Brother Young. As an offering for my sins, a smoking incense, Brother Young. A blood atoning for my sinning, Brother Young. Cause I sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young. Let only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only the song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com and consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.